You are listening to the cycling podcast De Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Kenyon's Run.
Well, where are we today, Daniel, on rest day number two?
We're in the heart of Ribera del Duero country.
Still in Castilla y León, aren't we?
Correct.
Even though we've driven a long way and we're not that far from Madrid now.
No.
It's funny. Today I saw signs for Vitoria and Bilbao, only about 150 kilometres in one direction. And as I drove further south, Madrid was only about 150 kilometres away. So we really are homing in on Madrid. It was a pretty miserable day, wasn't it, weather-wise?
It's going to be more miserable tomorrow. It's going to be windy.
A lot of anxiety around, I think, about that stage, isn't there?
Yeah, there should be. There should be, because it's very exposed, this part of Spain. Very high up. The last couple of days, we've constantly been above around
1,000 meters
altitude. Tomorrow is extraordinary. There isn't a single classified climb, but I don't think it goes below 700 meters.
No, and it's cold as well, which comes with that sort of height. Daniel, describe the place that we are.
It's a wine hotel, isn't it? As I said, we're kind of, the sort of centre point of the Ribera del Duero wine growing region is where the stage actually starts tomorrow, Aranda del Duero. And we're just to the east of that. It's a shrine to wine. It's a wine shrine, isn't it?
A wine shrine.
We haven't had any yet.
Some shrieking kids running around.
We will definitely be tasting some this evening, won't we, Rich? But yeah, I mean, I think your better place. Well, your room definitely deserves a description.
I'm in the junior suite, and I've got a jacuzzi in there. I know. I've third
Someone
one.
Taking pity on you?
I think so, because I didn't book any of them, but. Third one of the Vuelta, and huge room, very beautifully decorated, like almost a four-poster bed, but not quite. And it's lovely. And I had a jacuzzi before dinner, and it was a bit too hot, and I'm still
got a bit of a beetle,
still sweating. Anyway, what did you do today? Who did you see?
I was at Movistar, and in another nice hotel in the Parador in Lerma. And they had a press conference, Valverde, Nairo Man, Eusebio, the Silver Fox. And then I had a nice chat with Eusebio after I did quite a long interview with him for ITV. Don't know how much you'll see.
Any bombshells?
Not bombshells, but yeah, it was quite interesting talking to him about Nairo Man, because obviously it was a poignant moment, because it was Quintana's last, it was his last press conference with Movistar at a grand tour. So, he's a very dignified character, Nairo Man, isn't he? I think he gets a bad rap, really. And he never really makes excuses. And even today, he talks about how he'd not really lived up to expectations. He said he prepared very well. He does fight. He doesn't give up. If you look at his record in Grand Tours, there have been many occasions when he's failed to live up to expectations. But he doesn't abandon.
No, and we saw the tour this year. The stage that he won was after, he'd had some tough days.
Yeah, and he doesn't abandon. He doesn't opt out to then, go down the road and get in a break and get a soft stage win. And it was very much in that vein today, his sort of parting message. It was, I think a lot has gone on behind the scenes the last few years, and neither side has been particularly happy with each other for long periods in the last couple of years. But there was none of that really transpired today. There was a lot of sort of thank yous and I'm very fondly looking back on what they've achieved together.
He's stoic, isn't he, Nairo Man? I mean, if you were to put the whimsical flâneur on one end of the spectrum,
Quintana
would be on the other. And they're going to be teammates next year.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see how that works out. Yeah, Well, just talking to Unsue, so the Movistar manager, about Nairo Man and what has gone right and gone wrong with him. And, the irony of being a a team that's sponsored by a communications giant, and it's sort of figurehead over the last few years. Nigel Mann is probably let down by his communication, I think, within the team. I think that's what's really not done him any favours at times, in races and out of races. I think, you know, there was an incident a few last week, wasn't there, when, was it the first Manchester State to have Alambre, where really he should have told his team that he wasn't feeling as well or as good as they thought he was feeling. And I think that's fairly typical of him, and because he's stoic, he sort of keeps his own counsel. And sometimes that's to the detriment of the sort of team dynamic. And, you know, we've heard before, I remember an interview with Giovanni Visconti, the Italian rider, a couple of years ago in Corriere della Sera, where he talked about how sort of aloof and how impenetrable Quintana can seem in a team environment.
Well, I went to Jumbo Visma, who today announced a four-year contract extension for Primoz Roglic. There have been some rumours that he might leave with Dumoulin arriving, Tom Dumoulin. But I was there to see George Bennett, and I spoke to him. That'll be tomorrow's Kilometre Zero.
What do you make about? What do you make of the ROG announcement?
Well, it's standard, isn't it? The rest day announcement, especially with him in the lead, and just put to bed, I suppose, any of those perhaps unsettling to keep him.
For him, more on his side for him, to decide to stay there and commit.
Yeah, it's a curious one because, you know, if he wins the Vuelta, the logical next step is to go and try to win the Tour, isn't it? And you would imagine that's what he would like to do ultimately, but Tom Dumoulin will want to do that as well. And I don't know, I mean, George Bennett talked about the approach they've taken to a lot of Grand Tours where they've gone there with sort of two nominal leaders and seen, you know, who's got the best legs. I can't imagine them doing that with Dumoulin. I think Dumoulin's in a different bracket, really. I don't know. I don't know.
Dumoulin, the last time he contended for a major tour was the Tour de France last year. Last time he finished a major tour was the Tour de France last year. So he's missed a lot of racing. So there's a bit of a question mark over...
But the last three he's finished have been second, second and first.
But... Yeah, this is one of the things I was talking to Unsue today about. You know, the sport moves on pretty quickly, and especially at the moment, it seems to be moving on at sort of a kind of double speed. New names keep appearing. We've seen the emergence of Pogacar. We think we're going to see the emergence of Evenepoel on the sort of on a Grand Tour scale as well. So, you know, Dumoulin. I don't want to say he's going to look like yesterday's man, or he could look like yesterday's man very quickly, but you know, this kind of thing could happen. I mean, as far as Roglic is concerned, I mean, it's probably quite a wise decision, maybe a bit premature, but you know, we've seen many times before at Sky Ineos riders who, okay, have felt a little bit crowded out, a little bit cramped, because, you know, guys like Richie Port, and they've gone elsewhere and it hasn't really worked. And you know, when you have got a team where there's a lot of momentum, where they're doing things, you know, in a successful way, it can be a bit of an own goal to sort of leave an environment like that.
This is our press conference episode. Shall we go to our first question, Daniel?
Hello, Lionel, Richard, and Daniel. This is Nathan Karras in Seattle, a friend of the podcast and listener for the last couple of years. Thanks again for your great coverage of the Vuelta and all your other tours to date. I particularly think a standout episode was Stage 7 from the Giro d'Italia when Daniel was flying solo. Two-part question for you. First part is around Team Ineos and the Vuelta. I'm just curious what your thoughts are and kind of what their approach has been and what their successes or what they're kind of aiming for. It seems like most of the other teams have had a pretty good showing for stage wins or getting jerseys or even being in strong presence in the breakaways, but Team Ineos has been decidedly subdued without some of the mitigating factors that Education First has had, for example. And then my second part of my question is for Daniel, and just curious what he sees as kind of the new dawn for Arsenal as far as... same old with our defense, or is he seeing things moving in a more positive direction with the current squad? Thanks again, and look forward to hearing your response.
Oh, Daniel, I think your face lit up there. I think
yes,
that's
how long
the best God,
how
ever
long
had.
Have you got? I mean, now you're talking.
Okay,
that's a
okay.
real podcast.
I'm going to set a budget.
That's a real podcast.
Come on, Nathan. Thanks for your question, Nathan. Thanks for the first question, Nathan. Team Ineos, they've been poor, haven't they? I mean, they've actually had a poor season. I mean, apart from winning the Tour de France, finishing first and second at the Tour, Sivakov and Bernal have been their strong riders this year, and a lot of the riders haven't really performed all that well.
No, I suppose not. They've used the Vuelta this year to basically give a couple of guys their head, really, haven't they? Guys who have not had many opportunities or not had opportunities to lead the team yet. So Wout Poels and Theo Gegenhardt, they've not led the team in 3-week races, and it hasn't quite worked out for various reasons.
I've got a sort of theory. I don't know if this stands up at all, but over the winter there was a lot of uncertainty around the team, an expectation, I think, that they wouldn't carry on, because I don't think anybody thought that a sponsor would come in to replace Sky. Given the struggles that other teams have had to find sponsors, it seemed crazy to imagine that another 30 million, 40 million a year sponsor would materialise for Team Sky. And I wonder if that uncertainty over that, you know, very important winter period when guys are preparing and maybe, you know, keeping their options, or maybe spending a bit of time and energy on speaking to their agents, looking around, having conversations with other teams, I wonder if that's just had some kind of effect.
Yeah, I also wonder whether they were given enough of a refresh in terms of recruitment last winter. You know, it applies to all sports. When a team's very successful, almost the worst thing you can do is kind of trust the status quo and think that you're going to continue to be successful with the same guys using the same formula. And Ineos didn't make a lot of changes in the close season, did they? And they've sort of gone with the same guys. And, you know, it's very difficult to know without being inside the team whether there's a kind of staleness that's crept in.
But it is noticeable that the guys who are really performing are the young riders. Theo Gegenhardt here, Pavel Sivakov, Egan Bernal.
Yeah.
And Chris Lawless as well.
Yeah. And they've also been, obviously, hugely unlucky with Chris Froome's crash of the Dauphiné. I mean, was it in Froome's plans to do the Vuelta as well? Because, you know, we could conceivably be sitting here talking about Froome having won the Tour de France and then also be well on his way to winning the Vuelta. So, you know, luck plays a huge and often underestimated, underplayed role in these things.
And you've got 30 seconds on Arsenal, Daniel.
Very optimistic, Nathan. Very optimistic. But I'm always optimistic about Arsenal. I hate all the negativity online. And
maybe the answer is
water polo.
Arsene Wenger to Team Ineos.
Yeah, I don't think that's the answer.
Hi, guys. Here, Miguel from Galicia, Spain. Recently, I was listening to Jonathan Butters explaining how much does the sponsor's interest affect the design and performance of a team in terms of riders and races. He explained how his team struggled when changing from Garmin to Cervelo, which meant a change of focus from Grand Tours to Classics and one-week races. This, he said, explains the poor performance as a team and their struggle to win during a few years, which you talked about in a Kilometer Series special and a few podcasts already. I wonder, how can you explain other teams' performances, and in particular I'm thinking about Dimension Data, which couldn't really find the momentum since they switched from Quebeca to Dimension, and now they plan to change to NTT into the next season. I guess that sponsors' interests are not something that we as a public are aware of, but I would love to know what do you make of it as a factor when it comes to the overall performance of a team. Thanks very much, guys, for your work. I really love your coverage from all the Grand Tours, and the Kilometer Series are amazing. So keep it up. Thanks.
Thanks for your question, Miguel. Well, to what extent do sponsors dictate where a team's focus lies? I mean, this doesn't maybe link back to the previous conversation we were having about Jumbo Visma and Primoz Roglic, but when you asked me whether I was surprised about the 4-year deal for Roglic, and I was more surprised from the point of view Jumbo Visma than for Roglic, actually, because I think one of the issues they've had with him has been, for a team with such interest in Holland and Jumbo Supermarkets having such interest on. I think they, you know, they found that his performance at the Giro and other races hasn't really had any impact in Holland, and so that's why it seemed to me to make sense to have Demoulin as a leader, and Roglic might have been dispensable for them, even if he is a Grand Tour winner. But I mean, with in terms of other teams, to what extent does the sponsor's interest have a bearing on the team and its focus?
Well, you would think a big one. You know, we're not party to all the sort of conversations and all the kind of pressures that are exerted on team managers from the sponsors. But it's an interesting question. You know, what identity does a team decide to give itself? Because they have to choose. You know, some teams do decide to become Grand Tour teams. Other teams you look at and it's very difficult to sort of discern what they're even aiming to be. You know, you mentioned Dimension Data there, and they seem to, well, they took a clear decision to target the Ardennes Classics with Valgren, Kreuziger and Gaspar Otto, who all signed last winter. It didn't work at all. And you know, one would think that's also, it's a strange set of races to really target. And you know, they've got other riders as well, and they hope the other riders will succeed in the Grand Tours, and they certainly thought that Valgren would go better. But some teams do get it badly wrong. Astana subtly changed their recruitment or their sort of roster in the close season last year. You know, I've spoken to a couple of people in the management there, and they really decided to go hard at the early season stage races, the 1 week stage races, and you know, with guys like the Izagirres, and you know, it was only three or four riders, but it definitely gave their team much more of a sort of stage race overall sort of GC bias, and it worked. You know, there's no guarantee that it is ever gonna all come off, but and then, you know, again on the other side of the coin, you look at a team like Trek Segafredo, who have got a lot of riders who are very versatile and you know, could be successful on lots of different terrains. I'm thinking about someone like Brambilla, who here at the Vuelta, I don't think he's got a contract for next year, and he's trying to get in breaks and he's trying to show himself. But that's a move that has not worked. You know, when he came from Quickstep a couple of years ago, he was very highly touted. Fabio Felline is another one, similar characteristics, could excel on a variety of different terrains. It's not worked either.
Sometimes teams are at the mercy of the talent they have as well that emerges. Teams somewhere, for example, you know, who have been Giant Alpecin, Argos, Shimano, they built themselves around Marcel Kittel and John Degenkolb in the early years because they had these talented sprinters on the team. So they built teams to support them very successfully. Tom Dumoulin then emerged, and I think his, you know, performance at the Vuelta in 2015 took them by surprise, but you know, they had a choice then. What
a similar thing happened with Mitchelton, didn't it?
With Mitchelton Scott as well, yeah. I think it was more of a conscious decision there.
I don't think they set out as a team that was, I think, modelled themselves really on what HTC had done very successfully with fast riders and time trialists, and that's what they were for the first couple of years. It didn't really work that well. They were sort of developing slowly, and then Matt White came on board and things started to look up, but then they found themselves suddenly. They found themselves suddenly with three very promising young stage racers in the two Yates twins and Chavez, and then I think that's when they decided to pivot really.
But I spoke to Luke Roberts the other day at Sunweb, and he said their focus next year is going back to classics and stage wins. You know, they're abandoning completely any idea of being a GC team because there are very few potential Grand Tour winners out there, and if you have one, you're kind of obliged to support them, but that swallows up a lot of resources and money. And it's almost like the two tiers, aren't there, in professional cycling or World Tour, where there are teams with a Grand Tour contender who need to support that Grand Tour contender. And then there are other teams who don't have that and can spread the risk a little bit. But yes, there are teams that don't seem to have any kind of clear focus at all.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour. The home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019. As they partner EF Education First and Canyon's Run.
Hello chaps, Nick from London here. The strong showing from Tadej Pogacar and Primoz Roglic at this year's Vuelta, in particular their first and second on Los Mochicos last week, has led some to refer to Slovenia as cycling's smallest superpower. Just wondering to what you'd attribute the recent surge in success of Slovenian riders. Cheers, and keep up the good work.
Slovenia. What's going on in Slovenia, Daniel? Well, that's a loaded question, maybe, after some revelations during the Giro about some untoward goings on in Slovenia. But, you know, Pogacar, Roglic, Matej Mohoric, it's a tiny country, isn't it? What's happened? What's produced these great riders? Any ideas?
Well, as you said, you know, there's a note of caution because one of the sort of key figures or who was incriminated in the Operation Adalas earlier this year in Germany and Austria was Milan Erzen, who was the sort of man behind the Bahrain Merida team, and he's kind of been eased out of the picture since the Giro, since that all came to light. But you know, he has had a role in Primoz Roglic's at the very early days of Primoz Roglic's pro career, and you know, there were a few Slovenian riders involved directly in that police investigation. So that's slightly concerning. On the other hand, you know, I spoke to Andre Hauptmann the other day, who was the first Slovenian medalist in a World Championships in 2001 in Lisbon. He was second behind Oscar Freire. And, you know, I was talking to him about what's the sort of demographic of cycling in the socio sort of demographic makeup of people who get into cycling in Slovenia. And he says, well, it's a working class sport, as it has been in a lot of places in Europe, and it's generally very hard-working people. He was talking about Roglic, he's from an area of Slovenia which was famous for mining once upon a time. I don't think it still is, but you know, they're sort of men of few words generally. They're quite, you know, as you said about Quintana, quite stoic. And you know, I suppose there is a degree of a kind of emulation effect. As I said, Hauptmann was a bit of a trailblazer back then. The trickle has become a bit of a cascade, hasn't it, of Slovenian riders. And, you know, as we've seen with British riders now as well, when whether it's the agents or the team managers start to realise that there is talent in that particular pool, they start fishing there, and that's what's happening. You know, the number of British riders that are turning pro next year or that have turned pro in the last two or three years is quite...
With a real range of
quite
teams,
astonishing.
Yeah.
And you know, and to an extent, it's a fashion.
Hello, chaps. It's Chris here from Worcester. And you'll be glad to know that I can confirm that there'll be at least two people coming to watch you there. I've got my two tickets, so I'm really looking forward to it. It's a great venue, actually, Huntingdon Hall, where you are. You may not know, but it's a restored 18th century chapel. So everybody's sitting in the old box pews. So great small venue, but really good. I'm sure you'll enjoy it there. Anyway, my question is about what's happened to Wout Poels and Kwiatkowski, in fact, as well, but particularly Poels, because he's been kind of inconspicuous in this race. I mean, he wasn't that good in the Tour either, was he, really? Did he have a crash last year or something, I seem to remember, or is he something happened where he's not quite the same rider again? And also Kwiatkowski, he was pretty rubbish in the Tour, really. And he was quite good the year before when he was leading out Froome and Sky at the time had a good race. Poels was also reasonably good that year as well. But what's happened to those two? What do you think? And just an added one to that too is the first stage here when Poels and Theo Gegenhardt lost a lot of time. How come they finished exactly together? It's kind of a funny one, that I thought, because it, you know, I mean, one of them had a bad day, fair enough, but then the other one would have presumably not wanted to lose time being the second leader. Anyway, keep up the good work. See you soon in Worcester. All the best.
Hi, guys. Stephen from Belgium here. I have a question regarding Team Ineos. Do you guys think that Team Ineos has an approach to Grand Tours that is so much focused on general classification that when that doesn't materialize, like this Vuelta, that they don't manage to succeed in the secondary goal of scoring stage victories, because we saw about Poels and Theo Gegenhardt try a bit, but it seems that they as a team are just not working towards the goal of stage victories. I'd like to know your view on that, and good luck with the rest of the Vuelta.
Well, we had a question about Team Ineos earlier. That was Chris and Stephen there. Thanks for your questions, and looking forward to seeing you in Worcester. Well, links to the previous answer. Those guys have underperformed this year. Wout Poels, Michał Kwiatkowski, and others. And well, Wout Poels, we're pretty sure is moving to Bahrain Merida, aren't we, Daniel? Are we pretty sure?
I'm not that sure.
Do you think he might stay?
I think there are a couple of teams maybe still in the shake-up.
Okay, well, we don't know why Poels and Kwiatkowski and others have underperformed this year, but they have. I think Kwiatkowski certainly took he was supposed to go to the Tour of Poland after the Tour de France, and I think he felt like he'd got his preparation wrong for the Tour. He has been very strong there in the past, and he just got it wrong, whether he overdid it, but he wasn't where he wanted to be. I think he's a guy who is clearly very talented, and you have to ask whether he's in the right team. I can see him going to CCC eventually.
Well, they're desperate to get him. They've tried to get him already, but they're going to have to wait until his contract expires, which I think is probably the end of next year, isn't it?
But I can imagine Kwiatkowski being a sort of Greg Van Avermaet type, where he is the undisputed leader of the team and the guy who gets support in a lot of races, because he seems wasted in a support role, really, given the talent that he has. But otherwise, the other question about why did they finish together? Well, they'd both sat up, I think, at that point. I mean, I don't think it was a strategic or tactical. If you haven't got the legs, you haven't got the legs, and you might as well sit up. And it doesn't really matter whether you lose 9 minutes or 20 minutes, does it?
As far as stage hunting is concerned, I just think they're very mediocre. They're just like they're just another team when it comes to that particular discipline. And that comes from the fact that they don't really focus on it and they don't really practice it. I think generally when they go to stage races,
it's quite hard to win, to go from a very specific job in a sport role to, and I've spoken to guys before. I remember at the under 23 road race last year in Innsbruck, there were a few riders there who were on World Tour teams and had been all year sort of cannon fodder and used in a workers role, and it was very strange for them. James Shaw was one of them, actually, to find themselves in a race where they're actually contesting for the win and up there and attacking and following moves in order to try and win. That's a very strange or difficult adaptation to make.
As I say, when you're used to the briefing in the bus in the morning, every morning, being all about supporting a leader and what you're going to do to support a leader, and there's no real contingency discussed, and that happens, on 60 of your 90 race days a year, then it's quite difficult then to probably adapt to different scenarios. Yeah, and I just think it comes down to a lack of practice, really.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Thank you very much to Seb Piquet, the voice of Race Radio at the Tour de France, reminding us to tell you that this episode of our Vuelta coverage is sponsored by The Economist. Richard, you're a regular reader of The Economist. What has caught your eye this week?
I'm actually a subscriber, Lionel. I'm actually a subscriber now. Well, it's an obituary, and I love the obituaries in The Economist. I love obituaries generally. I used to write obituaries, actually, in a former life, and you would think that would be quite a morbid activity. Actually, it's kind of inspiring, because you are assessing somebody's life and telling a story about somebody's life and sort of validating it in a way by publishing a story about it. Not that they necessarily need validating, but it's often a celebration of somebody's life. The one that caught my eye in The Economist recently was an obituary of Richard Booth, a bookseller and king of Hay. Hay-on-Wye. Now, Hay-on-Wye is a famous town for the annual book festival, but it's also a centre of secondhand bookshops, and Richard Booth was the man that started all that in 1961. He arrived fresh from Oxford, flush with inherited money from Yardley's soap and toilet water, and sparkling with visionary schemes, and he opened a bookshop in Hay-on-Wye. This eventually led to the town having 40 secondhand bookshops. Sorry, if I didn't say already, secondhand bookshops. The most remarkable thing that I learned from this Avicii is that he didn't really like books. And at one point, he was selling secondhand books as kindling. But nevertheless, regardless of his whether he liked books or not, he really started this movement that established Hay as a kind of literary centre of life in the UK. And the Hay Festival is an amazing kind of institution, as are some other book festivals, but a really interesting life, interesting guy, not uncontroversial, declared himself King of Hay at one point, crowned himself King of Hay, and which got a lot of media coverage at the time, and a bit of an eccentric, but these are the best obituaries, aren't they? The obituaries of people who lived unconventional lives.
Yeah, and I think that indicates what a broad publication The Economist is. Broad in the subject it covers, but specific in the detail when it comes to the stories that it covers. And everything you read, you feel like you've unpicked a few layers of a particular issue. It's not just about economics, it's about a whole range of things: business, finance, sport, the environment, arts. And if you would like to get a free print copy of The Economist sent to your door so you can see what it's all about, then text the word cycling to the number 78070. That's the word cycling to 78070.
Hello, Cycling Podcast. This is Rob from The Ake in Holland. First of all, I would like to thank you for your very informative, objective and interesting coverage of the cycling scene in general and the Vuelta in particular. In my opinion, you really stand out in your journalistic approach and level of knowledge of the cycling scene. My question is about the way you gather knowledge about the non-English speaking side of the cycling entourage, and if you are willing to learn another language. You're all English-speaking journalists, and therefore you tend to speak about the English-speaking riders to get your information, maybe view cycling in a more Anglo-Saxon way. Cycling is becoming more and more international, and the number of English-speaking riders is increasing, I think, but there are still quite a lot of Italian, French, and Spanish or Colombian teams that do not speak English. Daniel speaks English, and in his coverage of the Giro, that was a real asset in understanding the way Italian teams and riders, and their maybe more Latin-like way of approaching the race. In the Tour de France, you incorporated the knowledge of François Thomazeau, but in this year's Vuelta, a Spanish or Latin view on the race is missing. So my question is, have you ever thought about or tried learning French, Spanish or Italian to get the information out of first hand? And do you think that would be an asset for you? I would love to hear your opinion about this. Thanks and greetings from Rob.
Thanks for your question, Rob in Holland. I'm joined by another Dutch resident here. I thought I'd put this to you, Orla, this question, because, well, one, you're a very gifted linguist as well. And we had a very similar question last year at the Vuelta, which Daniel answered. Now, Daniel's language skills are pretty amazing. He speaks fluent Italian, French, German and Spanish. So that is a huge advantage, definitely, in cycling. And I don't have that gift, or I haven't applied myself, Orla, you might say. I did have a conversation with Pierre Latour the other day. My French is okay. It's rudimentary, but it's okay. But you, Orla, as well, you speak a few languages.
I do, not as well, most of them, as Daniel, but I speak fluent French. I've been teaching myself Italian, Portuguese, German, speak a bit of Spanish, and I've been learning Dutch.
I mean, you speak pretty good German, don't you?
Yeah, my German, it's good. I mean, I've broadcast before in German, but what the problem is, and this is where Daniel has a massive advantage, is that to learn any language to any proper degree of competency, you really have to spend a lot of time in the country, or a considerable amount of time in the country, dedicating yourself to that, or just communicating with people. And that's where I've fallen down, because a few years ago I decided to do this, partly, mainly for that reason actually, because I thought my job is so international. I now specialise in cycling, but I've done a lot of other sports and just internationally, and I thought it'd be a huge advantage. And so I spent a winter, essentially, I had a 3-hour commute every day to and from work, and I spent a winter just listening to, it was at the time German and Italian, with a bit of Portuguese, and the Spanish I just teach myself. And I got to a really good level in all of them. But I had a child at the time. I've now got two kids. And so going off and spending time in these countries to properly learn it is actually really difficult. So that, I think it is a huge advantage. And I think even if you don't have a fluency in a language, it's always beneficial anyway, because you can get to learn more about a writer by reading interviews that they've done in their native language, by listening to what they're saying to their own domestic journalists as well, and understanding at least snippets of it. You get a feel for them. And it's also a brilliant icebreaker, I think, in this world. We travel around in this bubble that where English is the dominant language. At the Vuelta, you know, it's Spanish as well. But it's so easy as an English-speaking journalist just to chat to people. As soon as you start speaking to them a little bit in their language, then you've made a connection, and then they remember you. And that's really useful. And actually, I've been learning Dutch since I moved to Amsterdam. But because where I live in Amsterdam, in the centre, everyone speaks such fluent English. It took me until, the women's tour this year, for me to speak probably more Dutch than I do in my day-to-day life in Amsterdam, because Tim Harris was there and he discovered that I was learning Dutch. He speaks fluent Flemish. So he insisted he was only going to speak to me in Flemish, and I had to reply in Dutch. And it was the same. I met Marianne Vos's father, Henk, who his English is quite basic. So we would chat to each other every day in Dutch. And so it's really useful in that sense. Even if you don't get to a degree of fluency, I still feel like I'm on a trajectory. So it's not like I'm stopping learning. But any extra bit that you can have to connect with writers, to connect with DSs, to understand their world, I think is really useful.
I totally agree. I mean, a shortcut to that is the journalists. We get a lot of information. I mean, you tend to get more information from other journalists anyway than you do a lot of the time from DSs and writers. There's a couple here. I was speaking to Hugo Kurwitz the other day, the Belgian journalist who's here for Het Nieuwsblad. You know, just a mine of information. And if you speak to Spanish journalists, you can also find out an awful lot about the Colombian writers, the Spanish writers, and so on. And we have had Fran Reyes the last couple of years as part of our team. He's working for the Vuelta this year, so he couldn't be part of the team. I hoped we'd have him on a bit more, but he's very busy doing that job. At the Giro, we have Daniel, which is pretty much the same as having an Italian journalist. Marco Pinotti said Daniel. Yeah, did I say the tour?
Yeah.
At the Giro. Marco Pinotti said Daniel knows more about Italian cycling than any Italian. And at the Tour de France, we have Francois Tomaso, and it is a huge asset, and we'd love to have the same at the Vuelta. And we're kind of, you know, certainly open to that, because it does just open a door into that culture and a lot of the riders, and it's something we want to do. And, I think you and Daniel are, you know, have a gift for languages, and I think once you know two, it's easier to then learn a third. And I'm stuck at, you know, my pretty, you know, passable French when I absolutely need to speak it, but I'm definitely not as confident as you are.
But I think that's exactly it. It's confidence, because I've never taken Spanish lessons. I've only ever taught myself. If I was here with a Spanish speaker traveling around, I would let them do all the talking. Nobody on our team speaks Spanish, and so I'm doing all the talking in Spanish to the policemen, to the drive-through at McDonald's last night. I'm the only one who's.
What's Spanish for a Big Mac?
Uno Big Mac. I had a McPollo, which is a chicken sandwich, with patatas normales. But that's really, because you're always travelling with people who speak the language really well. And so it's not necessarily laziness. It's more effective to let them do the talking. What you need to do, this is what I mean by you have to move to a country. You have to put yourself in a position where your only form of communication is searching, you know, mining your own brain, really. But what I was going to say is, while it is really useful, you know, to pick through the brains of journalists from that country, I do find I am a journalist, I think, who gets an awful lot from human interaction, and I'm most interested in the human behind any of the stories. And for that, you really need to speak to the writers. And, I mean, we were speaking in English, but one example I thought of the other day, whenever we had Primoz Roglic on the show, I've never had the chance to speak to Roglic before, and he comes across in interviews as being very measured, very calm, and just doesn't give very much away. But when you speak to someone and I asked about his family, and then his eyes lit up and then he was human, then I got a feel for what matters to him. And you can't really get that from reading other people's interpretations or listening to other people's interpretations, because you'll only have that filter through which to see the writer or the situation. So yeah, learning the language I think is a bit fundamental, but it's hard. It's hard. You know, we've all got busy lives and busy jobs, and this isn't the only thing that we do, and most of us are families. So it's a work in progress, I think.
Hey up, Gareth here from Nottingham. I've got a couple of questions for the Cycling Podcast press conference. My first question relates to some comments that Nick Schultz made during his diary entry for the time trial the other day. He mentioned that he and quite a few of the other domestiques riding would use it pretty much as a third rest day, just riding to stay within the time limits for that stage. So I was wondering why these guys don't ride on their road bikes rather than use the time trial bikes, road bikes being a bit more stable handling wise, less chance of crashing, and would have thought more comfortable as well. So I was just interested to know what you guys thought of that. My second question is a question for Richard. I've just been listening back to Friends of the Podcast Grand Tour Diary for the Vuelta. And at the end of Richard's entry, he said that he was looking forward to the Vuelta coming to Benidorm in 2019, because it would give him a chance to tell his Benidorm story. But I don't believe he's done that, so I'd just be interested to hear Richard's Benidorm story. I'll see you guys in Leicester. I've already got my tickets and I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks for your question, Gareth. I think that's a really good question. In fact, I put it to Nick Schultz, and we'll hear his diary in a moment, and James Knox's as well. I think it's a really good question. I mean, why do guys ride on their time trial bikes? Do you have a... I haven't heard what Nick says to this yet.
You've still got to make the time limit, haven't you? And the sort of aerodynamic gains that you get from a time trial bike are just
faster.
Free. It's just free.
Free
time,
watts.
Isn't it? Free watts.
Yeah, I guess so. As the other question, disappointing, I'm afraid. I said that because I just read about Benidorm and about how the mayor of Benidorm was instrumental in transforming that town into a tourist destination. This is probably not as salacious as you imagined it might be.
Did we not tell the story in the first week of the podcast?
I mentioned it, I think. But I thought it was a really interesting story. And it was interesting because it sort of helped to define Spain's image as a tourist destination in a way. So it's not that, but when it came to the tour this year, I couldn't find where I'd read this, and I couldn't find the story. And I actually spent some time with Lionel trying to find the story that I'd read, and it was great. But I think I read it in a book, and I can't remember which book. So sorry about that.
Well, he, the mayor in question, Zaragoza, his name was, Yeah, saw an opportunity. I think bikinis were already being worn widely in Northern Europe, and he knew about this. And there was obviously quite a repressive regime, very repressive under Franco. But this fella, Zaragoza, kind of prided himself on being very liberal, and he decided that the bikinis were going to be allowed in Benidorm. And he supposedly, legend has it, got on his Vespa and rode 8 hours to Madrid. To have a personal conversation with, face-to-face conversation with Franco, and he persuaded him.
Well, there you are then. There's a story. Maybe, yeah. I don't know, maybe we've read the same book, but it's a good story. Anyway, let's hear from Nick Schultz, who does answer this question as well. Here's Nick and also James Knox with his rest day diary.
Okay, rest day number 2. Very easy one, nice sleeping till nearly 10 o'clock, a lovely breakfast, prepared by our chef Nikki, and then a cold and drizzly ride actually. It was 9 degrees and spitting rain, only did 20k I think, kept it really easy, came back to the hotel, saw the osteo then just before having lunch, then had a nice long siesta, had about an hour's sleep, woke up, had a little snack, and then spent an hour on the massage table, which pretty much brings me to now. So now I'm just hanging out for dinner, get some more food in me for a long day tomorrow, which is unfortunately predicted to be super windy, so in typical Vuelta style, a stage that could have been pretty controlled and more or less flat is going to be marred with strong crosswinds. Just got to love it, haven't you? There was a question from a listener in regards to the time trial back in the second week. And it was in regards to the fact that I said I went easy in it and that a lot of riders did so. And if that's the case, why don't we just ride our road bikes in basically for the reason of being more comfortable? Well, the TT bike is significantly faster. So I guess by riding the time trial bike, you actually just get to ride easier. Whereas if you were to ride your road bike, you'd have to ride pretty hard to make the time cut. I think it just wouldn't be ideal. It's also just nice to do something different on a personal level, go through the motions a little bit, spend a little bit of time on the TT bike, as I'm not one to do a lot of it. And I also don't get a lot of soreness from riding it the next day. But yeah, that's a really good question, and certainly I can see where you're coming from. But yeah, I think it's from a pure speed perspective. The TT bike is just a lot easier to go a lot faster. So yeah, that's all from me today. I'll try and get the last few hours of rest in and a good night's sleep before heading back to battle tomorrow.
End of the second rest day now. Been another lazy day. Making the most of feeling tired and basking in my own fatigue. Yeah, not a lot to talk about really after a tough day out yesterday. One of the best days in in my career as a rider, so I was happy with that. Moved up the GC into 11th, so didn't expect to be in this position, so that's nice. Phil's chipping in that I had a lot of luck getting up to 11th, so that's his opinions on the matter. Yeah, a lot of help as well to get there. Nice to have four guys up the front. It was pretty nice, pretty cool move. 10th, what am I saying? Reading this question, stage win or top 10, yeah. Sort of got my eyes on both, I guess, you know. Feel like the legs are good to go for a stage win, but now got a good opportunity to try and move up or defend that GC position as well. So we'll see what happens. Keep focused. And today, just slept in as long as possible. Good lying. We had a lazy 40-kilometre ride into Burgos. Found a nice cafe. Started to rain and had to crawl the last 5K home in the rain, which was a bit of a shame. It's also really cold. Don't know why it's so cold. It was only 11 degrees for the most of the ride. And other than that, getting a massage and some physio. Some physio on the parts of the body. I get a bit stiff riding. The hips, the neck. Doctor checked my urine. That was all good. Not really done a lot, except watch the Tour of Britain. The Cumbrian stage in the Tour of Britain. Watched it from Edmund Byers. I knew all the roads. I used to ride over. I had a girlfriend who was at Newcastle University when I was like 18, 19. So quite a few times I rode over from my home in Kendal over to Newcastle and went like basically the route. So going in Sedbergh, Kirby Stephen, Brough, Middleton T, Stanhope, Edmund Byers, and then into Newcastle. So watching racing on roads that I knew really well. My dad grew up in Kirby Stephen, which was about 70 kilometres, I think, from the finish. And then in Sedbergh, they turned left down Dentdale, then over Barbendale. Some spots where, quite a few spots actually on the course where I did some foul races when I was younger. Then into Kirby Lonsdale, where I went to sixth form. Over the old Hutton course where there's some local road races and time trial circuit as well. So race roads I know really well from racing and training. It's actually like my favourite area to train, going east from my home in Leven, south of Kendal. So yeah. I wouldn't say I was jealous, but it was nice to see. Watching on Mark Donovan of Cumbria, hanging in there, hanging in tough. He's had a bit of a rough spell this year, so he looks like he was back in fighting fit, and also a lot of other people I know well in the race, so pretty entertaining watch, and Van der Poel was sensational to finish. Yeah, that's my rest day, really. Having a steak for dinner tonight. Set me up with some iron for the last week, and I'll see what I've got, so... Yeah. Hopefully it goes okay.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can get 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com.
Hey chaps, Mike calling in from the Washington, D.C. area. Loving the coverage of the Vuelta so far. Keep up the good work. So I've only been following the sport for a few years, but for my life, I cannot recall the Vuelta ever visiting Portugal. It's been to France a few times in recent years. I think they had a Grande Partenza in Nîmes a few years ago, and the time trial in Pau this year, which makes sense as the ASO owns and operates the Vuelta. But why no Portugal? Is there some political reason where, as a matter of principle, Portugal refuses to host the race, or the ASO refuses to send it there? Is it a question of geography, that a Grande Partenza in, say, Lisbon would be so far from any interesting terrain that the Vuelta organizers would need to insert several lengthy flat stages or a long transfer to fit such a stage into the rest of the race? I suspect this is not the culprit. As you mentioned in the last press conference, Spain has mountains and other interesting terrain pretty much all over the country. Can it simply be that no city in Portugal has raised their hand to host a stage start or finish? I'd have to think that Portugal has its share of stunning scenery and interesting terrain and would be well worth visiting. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for your question, Mike. It's a great question. I've actually left Daniel down in the bar. I came up to my room partly to try and research this properly, and I can't find it. Daniel swears that he has been to Portugal with the Vuelta, but he can't remember which year. I can't find it. We went very, very close to Portugal last year, and it is an obvious place for the Vuelta to go. I would say two things. Javier Guillen, the race director we had on Kilometer Zero on Monday, did make the point that the Vuelta doesn't leave its borders quite as much as, or doesn't cross borders quite as much as the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia. It does tend to stay largely in Spain, although this year we obviously went to Andorra and France. And I think a lot of resources, this is Daniel's theory, a lot of resources in Portugal go into the Tour of Portugal, which is broadcast live. And, you know, perhaps they want to preserve that as the jewel in their crown as far as cycling goes. Cycling is not quite as big there as it is in Spain, France, Italy. But there isn't quite the same tradition, not the same number of top riders, although there are a few. A start was rumoured for Porto some time ago, but that didn't happen. And as I say, I cannot find the last time the Vuelta went to Portugal. So somebody listening will know. Please let us know.
Hi, guys. It's Phil here from Glasgow. I've been a friend of the podcast from day one, and I'm currently speaking on Sunday. This is the first Grand Tour that I haven't watched any of for years and years and years. Should I start watching now? Thanks, bye.
Thanks, Phil. I think I know what Daniel's going to say to this.
Why? What am I going to say?
No,
I wouldn't.
Yeah, see, no, I was right. I mean, tomorrow could be quite good.
Oh, no, I shouldn't say that. I work for TV. I should say no, absolutely watch it.
Yeah.
No, tomorrow could be good. It could kick off, couldn't it?
Yeah.
But the guys most likely to lose time tomorrow are the guys who need to gain time, probably. The Movistar boys.
Phil, as long as you listen to the podcast, you'll not miss a thing. Don't you worry.
I would watch it. Well, there are going to be two beautiful and interesting mountain stages, if only for the landscapes, particularly Saturday stage, to the Gredos mountain range, to the west of Madrid.
Okay, Daniel, let's wrap up. Let's go for dinner in this lovely wine hotel. We did have lots of questions this week, and apologies if we haven't got to yours. We haven't got through as many of them as we would have liked, but we've run out of time a little bit. But we'll be doing another press conference next week. So if we didn't answer your question this time, send it in again for next week, because it's not really a question of quality. It's just a question of, as we listen to them, we answer them and we can't get through them all. But thank you very much, everyone who has phoned in questions. Much appreciated. Daniel, what do you recommend here? Apparently, if you wanted the lamb, which is the speciality, you had to order it in advance. Have you done that?
No.
Should we do that? Is there still time?
Big lamb man.
No?
Okay. No, lamb in Mallorca is very good. If anyone ever goes to Mallorca, some fantastic shoulder of lamb, particularly.
Well, we're going to have a delicious meal of some description. And Lionel's joining us tomorrow. Lionel's back. He's actually mid-air as I speak. That's exciting, isn't it?
Wonderful.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.